we're going to backtrack a little bit this evening because I felt like maybe we didn't make some things as clear as they might need to be. This pictorial thing that I've handed you, I've already mentioned, we're going to be using it in the days, weeks to come in relation to some of the things that we have to understand about how God created us as creatures of eternity. But before we get into that, I want us to look at the issue of our last study when we picked up on the question of why we had a Bible and what substituted for one before the Bible was actually produced. In terms of the biblical chronology given to us in Genesis, Abraham lived about 2,000 years after Adam was created, and it was another 2,000 years from Abraham to Jesus. And Abraham was told that his offspring would go down to Egypt and spend 430 years down there. So when you put those numbers together, we're talking about Moses beginning to write Genesis while they were in the wilderness and producing those first five books of the Old Testament, about 1500 B.C., give or take a couple hundred years, because there's some debate about that. But nonetheless, you still have a 2,500-year period from Adam to Moses where they didn't have what we have as a compiled record of God's words put in what we would call a Bible. But in our study, we were asking the question why we have a Bible, and the only answer that makes any sense is that God actually does love us. And I say it that way because it's fairly easy to say, I believe that God loves us, but it's a little harder to say, I believe that God loves me. And I have a friend that said he was going to get a bumper sticker that said, it's a whole lot easier to tell other people that God loves them than it is to believe it yourself. And there's a lot of truth in that, because our words to others are more easily spoken than they are believed. And the idea that God would love us is really a stretch when you get down right down to it.
He knows
us. And that's another reason why we doubt that He loves us, because He does know us. Every bit about everything about us. But that's His claim. And we have plenty of evidence that it's true in terms of the biblical record. He would have never sent Jesus into this world to have Him be subjected to the things He was subjected to, and then actually be subjected to the eternal death that sin was to bring upon the children of men. If He didn't care about us, He wouldn't have done it. The sacrifice that He made at Calvary was so huge, it beggars the imagination. We don't give it a lot of thought because it was over in a day, we say, or 3 days, but it wasn't. Whatever happens to God is a permanent, present thing for Him. So that to subject Jesus to this breach in the Godhead for the sake of sinners was an enormous thing. And what He did there was sufficient to take care of the legal issues of every sin that every human being that has ever lived had built up in terms of a legal legacy that He owed. So love is the only answer, and there's even a lot of confusion about that, because as I commented in Sunday school, love is a very complicated concept, and we're going to talk about it in our studies on Wednesday night, but not particularly tonight. But the Bible is a more specific revelation than creation. When somebody does something, the thing they do is a revelation of something about themselves. I think one of the theologians of the Reformation said that a person's theology bleeds out through his fingers. What that means is he does according to the way he believes. And when God created the heavens and the earth, He declared many, 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 many things about Himself just by creating. But He did the creating with human brains that were able receptors for the things that He did and and revealed by his actions. But after Genesis 3, the human brain and the ways of thinking were so corrupted that there are only basically a couple of things that you can decide on the basis of God's creation work. And Paul appeals to that in Romans chapter 1. That men are without excuse because the creation reveals the truth about God in such a way that leaves us excuseless. But the issue there is that he is a God of awesome power. It doesn't take a brain scientist to realize that anybody that could create a creation as big as the one that he is would have to be amazingly powerful beyond our ability to grasp. And I think that's even a part of the problem that we have sometimes in our relationship with God, because we know he's capable of doing a whole lot more than we can get him to do, because he does things according to a grand plan and he doesn't veer off of the plan in his pursuit of this kingdom of righteousness, peace and joy that's our destiny. So a lot of the things that we want him to do don't fit that scenario, and so he doesn't do them. And we wonder why, because as has already been mentioned, he already knows we're selfish. He knows everything about us. But nonetheless, it's the fact that he is so powerful that there isn't anything that we can even think of that he couldn't do except something that would be evil. He can't do that.
Daryl, we had a lady here in our church for years, and she got cancer, and and when she was in the hospital, a couple of us young girls went to see her. We were teenagers, and she said, "You know, I'm always telling people when they get sick or get cancer or something, just pray for God, just trust God, he's going to get you through this." But she said, "You know, when it's you, it's a different situation."
Yes.
And I thought about that when you said, you know, I thought that's a pretty good example of it. When it's us, it's different.
It is. Yeah. It is. And the reason is because we do have a tendency always to pull everything into how this affects me. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about you, it's minor surgery. When we're talking about me, it's major surgery. You've heard that before. But that's a fact, and it's an unfortunate fact. But nonetheless, it doesn't affect the fact that God has proven his love in history by the sending of his son. He just wouldn't have made that kind of sacrifice if he didn't have our good in mind. But we did that study asking the question about why we have a Bible and they didn't, because the question is, if they didn't have a Bible, does that mean that God didn't love them? And of course we tried to answer that by saying that God had not left himself without a witness, even though they didn't have, as we know it, an organized, written, specific revelation like we have here. But we're told in this revelation that there were prophets. Enoch was the notable one before the flood. And our Bible tells us a specific prophecy that he made. It was a vision of the coming of Jesus with 10,000 of his holy ones to render judgment upon the wicked world. And that was, as we said last time, a second coming prophecy. So Enoch knew before the flood that there was going to be a time when God would bring judgment upon the whole creation in the form of bringing many thousands of his holy ones with him and wreaking vengeance on the world for its wickedness. And that didn't have to do with the flood. We were also, however, made aware that Josephus, who was a general in the Roman army, but he was Jewish, wrote a history of the Jewish nation, and he said in that writing that Seth originated the organization of the stellar heavens by identifying the constellations in the heavens. When you live 900 years, you can learn an awful lot about the heavens, and in Psalm 19, it says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handwork. Day unto day utters, reveals knowledge, and night unto night utters speech," or something along it. I got those twisted around. But the fact is, God's organization of the stellar heavens, Moses said in this book that it was done for signs and seasons and stuff like that. So I just wanted to make sure that we understood that issue of the stellar heavens and the truth that's contained there, because the sun travels in the same pattern every year. It takes 365 and a quarter days for it to run, but it's not a circle, it's an ecliptic, it's an egg-like shaped track through the heavens. And there are 12 major constellations that are right on that track. And so Seth divided that ecliptic into 30 degree segments so that there were 12 30 degree segments in this 360 degree, even though it wasn't a circle, it was still 360 degrees. And he studied the stars, and he got information from God somehow. I mean, we're not told this. Josephus is the one that said that this happened. But the fact is, the information from those ages has come down to us, even the symbols. I mean, the things that signify the constellations, like Virgo, the woman with the sheaf of grain in one hand and the baby in her arms. Leo, the lion. Taurus, the bull. All of those were ancient, ancient, ancient. They're traceable in our history all the way back as far as we can trace our history. And they're even here in the book. Some of them. So, given that, what he did was he gave each of the 30 degree segments a name that coincided with the constellation that was sitting right on the ecliptic, but there were in every case three other constellations that were within the framework of that 30 degrees. So there were actually four constellations that they knew about in each 30 degree thing, and that meant that originally there were 48 constellations, 12 of which were the major ones, and then the other 36 were addendums to that information that was added to the main thought of the constellation. And they started their study of that with Virgo and went all the way around until Leo, so that Leo and Virgo are back to back, but you're going in the wrong direction. You don't go from Virgo to Leo. You go from Virgo all the way around and come back to Leo. And that's a very interesting reality in relation to Jesus, because Virgo represents a virgin birth, and Leo represents the reigning ruler, king. And Jesus in his first coming was a virgin-born redeemer. And in his second coming, he's going to be the line of the tribe of Judah. So these things are in our Bibles, but apparently Seth knew about that. So, he called them houses, the houses of the stars, and there were 12 houses, 12 constellations. And they had theological names, Virgo and Sagittarius and Aquarius and Taurus and Leo, and they all had these names that signified the same things that Ezekiel saw in Ezekiel 1 and 10 in his vision of the glory of God. We told you that there are four basic ideas that start with Leo at the top, with Virgo next, and then going down to the Scorpio, and from there down to Aquarius, and then up to Taurus, and then back to Leo. Those are the four major. And those are the faces of the images in Ezekiel 1 and 10 and Revelation 4. So it can't be a coincidence. This is telling us that the ancients didn't have a Bible like we have, but they had the information that's in our Bible to a great degree, because they knew about the virgin birth. They knew about the conflict between Scorpio and we saw Ophiuchus last time. They knew about the water bearer who would pour out his water from his buckets. They knew about the Taurus, the bull, who would use his horns to defend and effectively serve the nation or the people. And they knew about the coming reign of Messiah. So those are the kinds of things that we know about from what they knew, and how they got that information, I don't know. I mean, nobody knows. We're told in our Bible that we get this information because God's Spirit moved in the minds and hands of men that recorded it, so that it's inerrant, infallible, absolutely trustworthy. But they penned it because it's written. But Seth did this because he wanted to communicate his theological grasp, his biblical perspective, if we want to call it that way, of God's entire plan. He wanted to communicate it to his offspring, and he expected them to pass it on from them to their offspring and so on, so they would pass it down. The problem with that, as we pointed out last time, was that men are accused in this book of having an extremely strong penchant for worshiping and serving the creature rather than the Creator. So that, for example, when Moses made that brass serpent, they turned that into an idol within just a little while. After looking at it would heal them from snake bite, they turned that into the healer rather than the God who provided it. Well, in the record of Moses' dealings with in the book of Numbers, you remember the story of Balaam, who was hired to bring a curse on the nation. And, you know, it's a well-known story because his donkey talked to him. But in the things that God put in his mouth to speak to the king that had hired him, there's references. For example, in Numbers 23:22, he refers to the wild ox, which was Taurus. And two verses later, in Numbers 23:24, he says, as the lion lifts itself up. And then in 24:9, as a lion again. And that's a clear reference to the lion of the tribe of Judah, Thesis. And then in Numbers 24:7, he refers again to the lion, and that's Leo. And then it's in Numbers 24:7. I got this out of order here. Water shall flow from his buckets. That's a direct reference to Aquarius in the pictorial thing that I gave you. Aquarius is down on his knees. He's filled his buckets of water, and the water's pouring out in a stream. And the fish, which was a symbol of God's people, are swimming in the stream. It's the only way they can stay alive. It's the exact opposite of the way we are. The Sea of Galilee, for example, was a scenario of death. And that's why the disciples were terrified when they were caught in the storm, because they knew that as air breathers, if they were sunk into the sea, they'd die because the water would kill them. But in the imagery that was imposed by Seth, the people of God were the fish, and they were forced to live in, like fish out of water, they were forced to live in a wicked and evil generation of people. And in order to stay alive, they had to stay in the flow of the water of the water bearer so that they could live. It's all imagery. But Jesus stood up on the last great day of the feast when they had this big focus on the living water, and he said, if any man thirsts, let him come to me and drink. And so the imagery is there. It's in our Bible, but it was back there too, according to Seth. And Stephen himself, the guy that was martyred in Acts chapter 7, in verses 39 to 43, he quotes from one of the prophets that says that God was really unhappy with the nation, because all the while they were wandering in the wilderness, they were carrying the tabernacle. It was supposed to be Yahweh's tabernacle. But Stephen said, you were carrying the tabernacle of Moloch, and you were worshiping the star gods. And Balaam is actually one who saw those camp standards. Each tribe had a pole with a flag on it, the standard. And they had the pictures of the gods, the images that were supposed to be turning them to think about God, but they had turned it into their own God. So you'd have a standard with Leo and the tribe of Judah, and all of 12 of them had these standards, and you can actually identify them if you just follow the pattern that's given in this book. So they had turned the creature into their idol, and they worshipped and served the stars rather than God. And that's being carried on today in the most crass way with astrology, where they try to predict your life experiences for today by deciding what sign you were born under, and that kind of stuff. All that is just paganism. But I wanted to go back over this so that there would be a clear understanding that God never has left men without a sufficient amount of information that if they would trust Him, they could walk in the light and have the experience of His life. He upped the ante, starting with Moses, when he put it down in writing. Because in the generations before that, the passing on of the theological reality was dependent upon the faithfulness of the father who is passing it on to his children. And we know they weren't faithful. So they were turning this theology of Seth, they were turning it into the mythologies that come out in the Greeks and the Romans. Instead of one God with these characteristics of grace to us, they were turning them into multiple deities. They were no better than the men. They fought with each other and they lusted after human women and they did all the stuff that men do. So it was a twisting. And because the truth was being so twisted, humanity was at risk of not having any truth at all. So Moses began to write. And now we have a revelation in a written form that makes it very difficult for men to change the words. There's been attempts made by men, but generally speaking, you can almost pick up any Bible that's actually a Bible. You can pick it up no matter who translated it, and if you're interested in knowing the truth, God will reveal that truth through whatever translation you got, even if it's the New World Translation of the Jehovah's Witnesses. You have to skip some things, like, for example, they say, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was a God. But, you know, that's one little detail. It's really hard to mess up the revelation of a book this thick. You can, and people do it. But there's also those that worship this book rather than the God who gave it to us. We call those Bible-olaters. So, I think that we've probably said enough about that. In fact, we've said more than enough because we're almost out of time. But I do want to begin with this issue of that's on your handout, because we're talking about developing a biblical perspective. And that includes how we see ourselves. We're supposed to view God in the way the Bible presents God, but we're also supposed to see ourselves as the Bible presents us. And it's it's more fun to think about God, because He's loving and good and just and righteous and all that. It's a whole lot less fun to see what the Bible says about us and be honest with ourselves and recognize that we're not anywhere close to what we ought to be and all that kind of thing. But the truth of the matter is, there are certain things about us that we need to be absolutely committed to as people of the Bible. And the first one is this matter of being, man is a creature of eternity. And that means basically two things. He's dependent because he's a creature. And he is everlasting because there isn't any end to him. So in our notes here on the page, at the close to the bottom, the first Roman numeral is God is. God has spoken. And he does love us. Those are the three big issues. That God is, and he has spoken. And what he has said is that he loves us. Well, those are the basic requirements that God insists on men embracing if they want to please Him. Because Hebrews 11:6 says, without faith it's impossible to please God, because he that comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who seek Him. Well, the fact that you have to believe that God exists, or you can't please Him. It's really, really, really hard to try to please somebody that's not there. And God doesn't take it lightly that creatures as puny and irresponsible as human beings have the gall to tell everybody around them that there isn't any God. I mean, it reminds you of Psalm 2, where the nations are imagining a vain thing. They say, we're going to cast off the cords that God has placed on us, and we're going to do things our way. And the Bible, the Psalm 2 says, God in heaven laughs, but it's a scornful laugh. Who in the world do these people think they are? The God that they live and move and have their being in, that created them and not only them, but this entire creation, which we'll say some more about Sunday morning, is so massively huge and powerful that even if he was wicked, you'd be a fool to rebel against him. Because you're going to lose. Yeah, in the final analysis, the one that's got the power is going to win. That's why the promise of a coming kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy is a valid promise, because we are serving an omnipotent God who has the capacity to make it happen. And he's going to make it happen. And that's why Paul says in Romans 1 that if you deny the cause and effect reality, where power argues for, the demonstrated expression of power argues for the power that was expressed. And if you're going to go that route, you've got an awfully big, awfully big person that you're dealing with absolutely no chance of unseating his plans. You can believe him and cooperate with him, or you can rebel against him and not believe him, but it isn't going to change his plan any. It's just going to change the way you relate to it. So God is, and he has spoken, and this is his word. And in this word, we have this long presentation of the entire issue of the love of God. It starts with sacrifices, death for sins, compensations that God has made for man's sin himself. So to please God, you have to believe that he is. And then you have to believe that he's a rewarder of them that seek him. And that means that it's faith. And faith isn't an empty, vacuous thing. Faith is a response to something that is known. God declares that he exists, and we believe him. If we don't believe him, it doesn't change the fact that he exists. It just changes us and twists our experience into a hopeless, black, bleak reality. A legitimate revelation from God is required by faith, and it posits the infinite existence of God, because he is, not was, not will be. He always is. And the legitimate meaning of this legitimate revelation is that God is inclined to reward. The inclination to reward testifies to his goodness. In Genesis chapter 1, every time God said something that was done, God saw that it was good. Every time. It was the serpent that came into the garden who posited the possibility that God had been lying all the time, and that all the evidences of his goodness were just deceptive things. Satan's basic accusation is God's not as good as you think he is. So that's where we are. We're in this issue of developing a biblical perspective. We have to start with the fact that God exists, he has spoken, and he is inclined to reward, though there are some other inclinations too, depending on how we respond to those first two things. And we're out of time.